Welcome to the Samuel Andreev Podcast. To support this podcast, please visit the donation page of Samuel's website or his Patreon page. There are links in the description. Samuel's Twitter is at Samuel Andreev.
Last month, I had the privilege of speaking with percussionist and drummer Art Tripp about his fascinating and utterly unique career. Art has worked with artists as varied as John Cage, Igor Stravinsky, Robert Kraft, Don Van Vliet, alias Captain Beefheart, Frank Zappa, Robert Austin Boudreau, and many others. While trained as a classical percussionist and timpanist, Art was seduced by the wild explorations of the avant-garde. After hearing Max Neuhaus play, he decided to perform works such as Stockhausen's solo percussion piece, Zyklus, and from there ended up participating in some of the most revolutionary recordings of the 1960s and 70s, albums such as Uncle Meat by the Mothers of Invention or Lick My Decals Off Baby by Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band. I started our conversation by asking Art to tell me about his early days studying percussion. I hope you enjoy it.
I auditioned for a few schools, and the best deal was with the Cincinnati Conservatory in Cincinnati, Ohio. So I started there in 1962. And within a year or two, I was hired to play fourth percussionist or extra percussion with the orchestra there in Cincinnati. And I just loved it. I mean, it was something I always wanted to do. And just loved playing in the big orchestra. And I even liked the repertoire, at least the repertoire that I played in. And I just liked the whole deal. I liked the classical approach and everything about it. So, but as I got a year or two older, I started getting more interested in new music. And from new music into the avant-garde music. And the problem is, in the modern symphony, and certainly the way it was in the 1960s, is you rarely got to hear anything modern. Their idea of modern was something written in 1911, or even earlier. So, I mean, we occasionally played Stravinsky or Ives or I don't know, but nothing that was going on at the moment. And that was what I really got interested in. So about that time, well, we went on a world tour with the orchestra in 1966. And I forget what before or after that. Anyway, I met John Cage. He was hired as the composer in residence for the University of Cincinnati. Conservatory music, college conservatory music, they called it. And so as a result, Cage played a lot of recitals and concerts at the conservatory, at the university, and around town. So I got to be involved in a lot of that. And we played a lot of his music. And in fact, I even attended a lecture he gave at the, I'm not sure if it was a university affiliated, but it was a group of psychiatrists association in Cincinnati. And the room was packed. It must have had 100 mental health type people working there, I mean, attending there. And along with us came Morton Feldman, who you know who that is.
Oh, yes.
And Morton was had just been in town, or he was passing through or something, and he heard his friend John Cage was being there, so he stopped by to say hello. And Morton was a lot of fun. He was a lot of laughs, a very loud New York brash kind of guy. And Cage was just the opposite. He was very retiring, shy, and very he often let you come to your own conclusions.
Okay, I've got like 1,000 questions for you, but okay, so one thing.
Well, anyway, so long story short, I knew my days in Cincinnati were, there wasn't any reason for me to stay there anymore. I mean, I love playing with the symphony. I love playing with the opera. I was playing with the Philharmonic, with its timpanists. I played with the Pops Orchestra, and I loved all that, but I just, at that age, you know, I was just burning up with the desire to play new music. So I thought, well, if I went to New York or Buffalo or someplace like that, I could get involved in something like that. So I applied for a scholarship to Manhattan School of Music in New York, and I got it. And so I went there in September of 67 and started at Manhattan School of Music. And while I was there, my lady at the time was friends with another lady whose husband was Dick Kunk, who was Zappa's recording engineer. And so Dick told Frank about me and my background, and he was very interested to meet me. So they called a couple weeks later and wanted me to come down to the studio, the Apostolic Studios down near the Village in New York. So I went down there and we had a talk, and he wanted me to play, and he was very impressed. And so I started with him that weekend. That was on a Friday, and we went upstate New York and played two gigs that weekend. And from then on, I just joined the band. We stayed in New York for a couple of months. And then by March, we left. We did a tour across country and ended up back in L.A. where the other guys were from anyway.
Well, it's an amazing story because you just described to me the way that you fell into working with three of the most important musicians of the 20th century. And that doesn't happen to everybody, right?
You don't have to be at the right place at the right time.
So what's the secret?
Well, it's just happenstance. You know, I think almost anybody will tell you that it's because of where they were. Well, you have to have the talent, but it depends on where you are, who you meet, what you get exposed to, what friendships you develop, that kind of thing. And a lot of it's just luck. You know, you meet people. That's why anybody that wants to get involved in music or anything else for that matter, certainly the arts or anything, you go to a place where they have that and you establish relationships. There you go. You know, you never know where it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So I want to back up just for a second because you described that your first teacher was in fact a timpanist. And
yes.
Yeah. And so normally in orchestras, there's a division of labor between the timpanist and the percussionist, right? They don't do
that. That's true.
Right. They don't do the same thing. So the percussionist doesn't play timpani and vice versa. So
right.
I'm just curious as to how that worked in terms of your own training. So you studied as a timpanist, but you ended up becoming a percussionist.
Yeah. I didn't really study timpani with Stanley. We had a little bit on it, but it was mostly general percussion. Stanley was a very accomplished percussionist as well as an accomplished timpanist. A lot of people think he was one of the best that ever played in the United States. And you could tell that by me, I'll tell you. He was something else. Still alive, by the way, and lives in Florida. So he's the one that introduced me all the percussion. When I first went, my dad took me down to hear the orchestra for the first time. And after the show, we went backstage and I got introduced to Wayne Pascucci, who at that time was the principal percussionist with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. And so we were asking him if he'd like to take me on as a student. And he I don't think he taught much, or if he did, he had a full load. He said, you ought to study with Stan Leonard anyway. He said, he'd be a much better choice for you. And so Stanley came over to him. In fact, he said, nobody practices more than Stanley Leonard. I'll never forget him saying that. So that's how I got introduced to him. And then as it turned out, he lived in the same part of town that I did, south of Pittsburgh, in a township called Mount Lebanon. So it was very easy for me to get over there for lessons. So I'm thinking that was around early 1959, and I worked with Stanley until I left Pittsburgh in 62.
Yeah, I don't think everyone understands that the difference between, let's say, an average orchestra and a truly great orchestra is often the timpanist, right? It's a really crucial role. And it takes a very special kind of musician to do that. It's an incredibly exacting and precise job.
It's also a very esoteric profession. There's only one in an orchestra.
Right.
There's only 12, 15 orchestras that you can really make a good living at. So the competition is pretty fierce.
Right, right, yeah. So to make it in a field like that, which is an incredibly competitive, is no easy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So would you say that he basically formed your percussion technique, or did that did you have other people that influenced you with that?
I wouldn't say that Stanley influenced my technique as much as Ed Wubold did later. Ed was the percussionist with the Cincinnati Symphony. So when I went to the conservatory, Ed was my teacher, and Ed really brought me along in terms of technique. And he was a devotee of Fred Hinger, who was the longtime timpanist with the Philadelphia Orchestra. So I kind of learned his method secondhand and with Ed's permutations. And so that's where I really came along with my orchestral percussion techniques. It was more with Ed. But as far as exposure to the instruments and learning a little bit how to play them, it was definitely Stanley. He's the one that turned me onto the vallophone and had me practice that, had me take a few piano lessons. And I wish to God I'd have continued with the piano, but I never did. And so that's pretty much, I'd say Ed was more formative for me with the, as far as technique. And then when I left Cincinnati and went to New York, I finally got to study with Fred Hinger himself. And at that time, he had left the Philadelphia Orchestra and accepted the position as timpanist with the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. So rather than up in the Spanish Harlem in New York, where Manhattan School of Music was, I'd get onto the Metropolitan Opera House, which is at Lincoln Center, every Saturday for my lessons. And all my other school work was up the Manhattan campus.
Right. Okay. So one of the reasons I wanted to go into some detail about that was just to underline your background as a classical percussionist. And so again, the trajectory you're describing, you know, starting from this orchestral world and then running into someone like John Cage, Morton Feldman and Zappa ultimately is really unusual, I think. And so you were saying it's obviously there's you have to have the talent, there's luck, there's happenstance, all of those things, but you also have to be somebody that other people want to work with, right? So it seems that when you first encountered people like Cage or Zappa, they had the idea that this is somebody that I can work with. So what do you think the qualities were in you that they recognized that they would think, you know, this is somebody I can collaborate with?
Well, first of all, I had the desire, and I'm easy to get along with, or at least I used to be. I don't know if I still am, but I certainly was at that time. And I just had an overriding desire to be involved in new stuff. And in fact, when I was at the Manhattan School, I used to get down to Slugs in the East Village and listen to Sun Ra. And I got to meet him, and I was talking with him, and I told him I had a recording of a piece I'd written for a symphonic orchestra that was in new notation and pretty avant-garde stuff. And he said he'd like to listen to it, so I brought him down the tape and left it with him. And I came back, I don't know when it was, a few days later, and he said he really liked it. And, so I was very impressed with his band. You know, he had kind of a large band at that time. I'm going to say 10 or 12 guys, which in playing in Slugs was not that big a place. It was always packed. And I told him, I said, you know, I'd like to join your band. I'd like to play with you. And he said, I'd like to have you, man. He said, but I can't. And I said, why is that? And he said, because you're white. And I said, okay, well, all right. You know, I guess I can understand that. Everybody in his band was black, and I guess he had a black following. I don't know if he did or not. It seemed like he had as many white folks in the audience as he had black folks. But so that was my first, it was very popular to talk about racism today, but that was my first exposure to it. But I really liked it. Listened to some of Sun Ra's recordings back when I was still in Cincinnati, and he knocked me out. I just loved his stuff. So when I got to meet him and talk with him, listen to him play and say, well, So I was interested in the new stuff all along. It wasn't, you know, the problem is, as far as going from, you know, leaping from symphonic type percussion, symphony, et cetera, into jazz, rock, pop, was that I hadn't sat down at a set of drums in several years. Anyway, I had my chops, you know, I could, my hands and so on were well in great shape. But as far as sitting down at a set of drums, I just hasn't done that in a couple of years.
Uh-huh.
So the first time I sat down at a set of drums, when Frank asked me to play some, when I went down to meet him at Apostolic. And so when I sat down, I just played a whole bunch of freeform stuff, the stuff I've been thinking about and, you know, more in the Sun Ra mode than the anything else. And it blew him away. You know, he really liked it. And so he called in. Roy Estrada was there out in the front room drinking coffee or something. So he had him come back. And first he said, can you play in five? And I said, well, yeah. So I play a little bit in five. And he said, oh, great, great. So he called Roy in in the studio, and I picked up his bass, and we played a bunch of stuff in five. I guess one of the tunes that they'd been playing that was happened to be in five. So I played along with that, and he said, "This is great, great. I can't, you know." And it sounds silly today when you say, "Can you play in five or seven?" Because everybody can do that today, but at the time, nobody could. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story. I had a long conversation with Don Ellis one time. He just happened to stop by my house because he had a flat tire, and in L.A. And he came up and we chatted. And he was telling me, he said, you know, the reason I hired, I think it was Steve Bonham, or I forget his name, the drummer he had in the late '60s. The reason I hired him because he was the only guy in New York that could play in five and seven. And there was nobody else was into the odd meters or anything. So anyway, that's kind of gives you an idea where it was in those days. And there weren't that many conservatory trained people in popular or rock or even jazz music. You know, it was a while before the Gary Burtons and all the great players that came from then on came on the scene, you know. So it was having a conservatory trained musician in the band was something of an anomaly. In fact, the mothers, we had a couple, or four actually, with Ian and Bunk and Don. They're all conservatory trained.
Yeah, well, part of the reason for that might be that, like, the symphonic world generally, in the classical world, has it's extremely competitive, and it's very difficult to find a spot in an orchestra, obviously. But at the same time, if you are able to get some kind of a permanent seat in an orchestra, financially, you know, you're stable. Right, you don't have to worry. Yeah. You don't have to worry about employment.
You bet.
Right, and that depends.
Plus you got a union.
Sorry.
Plus you have a union.
Right, exactly. Plus you have a union, so you're protected. If you join a rock band and start going on tours, you don't know if you're still going to be having any employment 6 months from now, right? So
no, you don't. That's right.
Yeah.
And the popular music, rock, jazz, it's notorious for guys not getting paid and guys getting screwed out of their money. And mm-hmm. It just, that's one of the reasons I got out of the business, but that's another story. But it's, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Where with a symphony, I mean, I could have stayed on and made my union salary every week for as long as I wanted to. You know, I wasn't going to get fired.
Right.
Unless I got sick or drunk or something. You know?
Well, there's something you mentioned when you were talking about Sun Ra. You mentioned that you had written a piece for orchestra. And you gave him yeah. You gave him a tape of it. So I want to know more about this piece. So first of all, I didn't realize that you also composed music, but I'm curious about how that came about and if you wrote other pieces also.
Not much in that format. I took an advanced composition class, or I took an avant-garde, I guess it was an avant-garde composition class by taught by Scott Houston. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He was a
no
pretty fair composer. Mostly around academia, but he did have, you know, he was an ASCAP and all that, and got a lot of his stuff played. But anyway, he taught a course in that, and there were eight or nine of us. And so that's how I got interested in composition. However, I hadn't gone through the normal studies that a composition student would. You know, I did take a class in orchestration, but harmony and all that, it wasn't, you know, but in the avant-garde, it was a different story. So, because I could stretch out and do what I wanted to do. So I came up with I met some guy like Michael Colgrass and, I don't know who all, but some guys that were using different types of notation rather than the common eighth notes and the staff and all kinds of other stuff. Plus, for my senior recital at the conservatory, I had played a piece by Karlheinz Stockhausen.
Oh, what piece?
Zikless.
Oh, right. Okay. Recycle. Yeah.
And that probably one of the first performances it ever got in that part of the country.
What year was this?
66.
That could
Stockhausen be. still alive, but I never met him. But I had to mail away to get the score, and then but it didn't come with instructions, so you just had to kind of figure it out yourself. So I played. That was one of the pieces I played on recital. So as a result, you play, and you're probably halfway familiar with the piece. You play a circle of percussion instruments, and in fact, it was because of playing that piece that I got to where I kind of like that setup where you have a bunch of percussion instruments in a circle around you and you can just go back and forth and around a circle and so forth and play. And I did a lot of that recording at Apostolic for Zappa, which was subsequently used on some of his recordings. You know, you can't do that on stage anymore and so forth. And even in some... I wish I could quote the title for you. One of the albums that came out in the late 60s, I can't remember. He used quite a bit of that on there. And that was from those recordings I did for Dick, and I think Ian Underwood was there. So I just fooled around and did a lot of improvisation. And they taped it. And so Frank was excited to use it.
Well, this is really interesting. I didn't know a lot of this. So you were writing avant-garde music. You took a course in avant-garde music.
Yes.
And you had tapes of these compositions. You gave what it sounds like you gave one of the very earliest American performances of Zyklus by Stockhausen.
Yeah, I'd actually seen a performance of that, which got me excited about it. I went up to Antioch, Ohio, Antioch College, and Max Neuhaus. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
Oh, yes.
He was traveling at that time, I guess, playing the university circuit, and he played a performance. That was one of the things he played, and I thought, shit, this is amazing. You know, I really liked it. So I went and talked to him afterwards, and I guess he was the one that. Anyway, I forget how I found out, but I had to write to Germany to get the score.
Yeah, it's a remarkable looking score, also.
I guess that's how we got into it. The different notation. It wasn't common. And there's no meter. It didn't say, well, you know, 140 beats to the minute. It was, you know, it was all, you know, pretty much spread out the way you wanted to play it.
So you were very deeply involved in avant-garde music well before you were working with Zappa and these other people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about John Cage and what that was like. So he was presumably writing an original piece at that time, and that was being worked on by the orchestra?
No, he didn't do anything with the symphony. He did more chamber pieces. I don't know if we played anything that he composed right at that moment. We played some stuff that he'd already written. Plus, he did a beautiful, he had a local pianist. They played his entire prepared piano repertoire. That was just beautiful stuff. I mean, you know, and he was there helping her prepare the piano, and they. He did a great job and got to hear all of that. Back to Cage himself, also did a performance of his infamous 3 minutes and 33 seconds or whatever it was at the concert hall, which was very nice.
What did you make of that piece? Or
well, I loved it. I think what people don't understand about Cage is he was very interested in ambient sounds. So it's not so much what the musicians were doing or weren't doing. It was what was going on while that was going on. Anyway, so when you're sitting there listening to that piece, which that is to say there's nothing to listen to from the piano, pretty soon you start focusing on what else is going on around it. and you can hear a siren going down the street, or you can hear somebody coughing, or you can become more aware of yourself sitting there, that kind of thing. So that is that's the true essence of the piece. It has nothing to do with what he's doing. He's just sitting there. As it happened, I remember that performance because some gal who was kind of a jokester, kind of a Weisenheimer, she walked around, came on the stage, and went out and confronted Cage while he was in the middle of the performance. And he loved it. He thought it was wonderful. How are you? He said, and how are you? So that was kind of neat.
Yeah,
but I think that's a very important thing to understand about Cage's stuff, is that he was very aware of ambient sound.
Yeah, no, there's a wonderful anecdote about Cage, where he was listening to a Beethoven symphony with sort of a bored expression. He had a friend over, and they had a Beethoven symphony on. And at some point, somebody rang the doorbell, and he smiled, and he thought this was wonderful because he loved the way that the doorbell sort of interfered with the symphony the effect that had on his perception of the music, and that made it a lot more interesting for him. So,
yeah, in fact, I think he told me one time that his dream would be to have everything that he ever wrote played exactly at the same time. he thought that would be. And I think Frank Zappa picked up on that later. I think he kind of had a quote like that. I think that's where he got it.
So did you have to rethink your percussion technique at all, or learn any new techniques when you were working with Cage?
No, except that you're working with a lot of new material. I mean, he did a lot of electronically enhanced stuff, you know, like just common everyday things. He put a contact mic on them, and so you move those around. And then you could, one piece we did, I don't remember the names of these pieces, but you could make any sound you wanted to. You could pick up a chair and drag it along the floor, or you could let out a scream, or you could do nothing, or you could, you know, play an instrument, whatever you wanted to do. And during a certain portion of the piece. And so in that case, yeah, I guess I didn't play some other instruments.
Do you remember?
I remember taking a xylophone mallet and grinding it along the strings of the piano, you know, and it made a loud screech, which was a great sound, but it ruined the mallet.
Yeah, well, that's the other side of these sort of extreme instrumental techniques, is if you might actually end up damaging a very expensive instrument. Do you remember who some of the other musicians were who were working with Cage on this project?
Well, we're all local, so I can remember some of my chums at the conservatory worked along with us, but you wouldn't know the name. I remember Jamie Hafner and Bob Woodbury, maybe Paul Piller. I'm not sure if Paul was involved with that or not.
But so none of these guys would have had any experience playing stuff like this?
No.
And
that was the case. That was the case wherever he went. I mean, I'm sure wherever he... wherever he was in residence, he would work with neophytes as far as his music.
Right.
We did one show down at a yacht club on the river there in Cincinnati, and Cage was to provide the music and do a lecture. Well, as the people came in, we recorded them all with a tape recorder. You know, in those days, it was just reel to reel. Recorded a few were asked them to say anything they wanted or make any sound they wanted or tell a story, whatever they wanted to do. So then we took those, and while everybody was eating dinner, we made tape loops of them. And we had, I don't know, 8 or 10 tape recorders to play the music back and speakers throughout the hall. So that was part of the music we used for the performance. We just started playing all those things at once. And it was funny to get their reactions. Some people recognized their voices, some didn't, and it was a little bit cacophonous. And Cage was running around just in heaven. He thought it was wonderful. Of course, by then he probably had 5 or 6 drinks. You know, he was a little bit pink in the face. But he thought it was just great. And then pretty soon, I forget what happened. We looked around, and he'd left. he just left before anything was over.
And so in this whole situation, so Morton Feldman was also there.
Yeah. No, he wasn't at that show, but he was there. He might have been there for another one, but he was there when we went to give that lecture, or when Cage went to lecture at the Psychiatric Association.
Uh-huh.
And I'll never forget, because Cage did a beautiful lecture, which he always did. And it was interesting and humorous, and nobody could figure it out anyway. And so when we left, after the lecture, they had a question and answer period. And so there were a lot of questions, and Cage always answered them, and it was a lot of fun. So when we left, the three of us were walking out of the building, and Feldman turned to Cage and said, "You know, Johnny," he says, "they just can't figure the artist, can they?" And he was right. And Cage cackled, because you can't take, you know, I don't know if there's such a thing as psychiatric science. I don't believe there is. But if there is, you can't take that and apply it to artistic endeavors.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was right. It was really funny. Feldman was a riot. He was a big jokester and pretty good writer, too.
Yeah. Feldman, for me, is really one of the great composers of the 20th century. He's a really.
Oh, you think so?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He's a very important figure.
Yeah, I'm not that familiar with his stuff. I've only heard a couple of his things. So.
Well,
knew he was a big name.
Yeah, there's a piece, I wonder if you've heard of it, called The King of Denmark, which is a solo percussion piece that he wrote.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I can't remember what year. It's probably, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I think he wrote it in the early 60s. And it's a great piece. I mean, a lot of people consider it one of the great pieces for solo percussion. And
I'll have to look that up and listen to it. King of Denmark is called?
It's called The King of Denmark. You might really enjoy it. And one of the things about it is he doesn't specify the instruments. So he just gives the general family of instruments. So he says, "I want like a metal instrument or a glass instrument or a wood instrument," and then you have to sort of choose what you're going to play it on. And he doesn't specify pitches, and rhythms are very loosely specified in a sort of graphic notation. But it's a great, great piece.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is, I think, and it's very popular as a recital piece also now for percussion students.
But he was a pretty big name in the avant-garde then, and of course Cage and David Tudor, and there was a lot of people at that time. There were some people, of course, Copeland was still alive, Stravinsky, everybody was still alive then. So it was a great time to be playing.
Yeah.
And then two summers, I did played with American Wind Symphony out of Pittsburgh. We toured the Inland Waterway and play concerts up and down the rivers in small towns who would never get the chance to hear a symphony orchestra, except Demi String, but it was the Wind Symphony. So with that orchestra, we played, the leader and the owner of the group was called Robert Austin Boudreau, and who's still alive. And he commissioned a lot of new works. So we got to play pieces by Alan Hovhaness and Villa-Lobos,
oh, yeah.
Robert Russell Bennett. There's half a dozen. I can't even think of their name. David Amram. Quite a few people, you know. So that was a nice experience, too. So at any rate, so Boudreau commissioned a lot of works, and so I got to hear a lot of new music then. I wish I knew new music today. I really don't follow it. I don't know who's writing outside of yourself and a couple of other people, but... Although I've been hearing a lot about this Jacob Collier fella. Have you heard
of
him?
Oh, yeah. Well, one thing that's happened in new music is that, well, because of the internet, it's really changed things a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So there are people becoming famous on YouTube and, you know, establishing real careers for themselves that way, which is quite amazing. And that possibility didn't exist even 10 years ago.
In fact, I remember it was a big deal if I was able to find a recording of Paderewski or somebody like that. I can't think of the names offhand, but, you know, the guys are doing new stuff in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You just had to be lucky if you're able to find a recording of it. And that would be an LP.
Well, yeah, I mean, you described having to write away to Germany to get the score for Zyklus. And, you know, it, even... Well, for that matter, when I was a teenager, I was really interested in Stockhausen. but I couldn't find the scores, and it was very hard to find the CDs. They were very expensive, and they had to be imported from Germany, and it would take weeks to get them. And the scores cost a fortune. You know, I'd have to save up to buy one, and it would arrive a month later, and this sort of thing.
Oh yeah.
And that's completely been transformed now by the internet. So you can get scores instantly. And recordings, obviously, also. So you don't have to wait anymore to see anything. And that's
definitely the upside, is the instant communications. The downside is everybody wants everything for free.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So,
in fact, my buddy Bill Harkleroad told me that's why he quit writing. He quit composing because everybody wanted everything for free. There was no way to make any money.
Yeah, it's a really, really difficult thing to navigate. That's for sure.
I don't know how in the hell the guys do it today. I mean, everything that, if you record something, all of a sudden, boom, it's instantly everywhere. And how can you monetize that? Very difficult.
There are ways to do it, but it's extremely complicated. I mean, yes, you're right. There's two sides to it. So on the one hand, it's much more democratic. Anybody can put out their music. But at the same time, the odds that you'll be able to make any kind of a living from it are much lower.
Well, so You're better off in academia and trying to get some stuff published and played and that kind of thing. You're better off.
Well, a lot of
trying to be out here on the road.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's what a lot of people do, is they go for an academic career. And
they have to.
Well, let's talk about that in relation to you, because you eventually did get out of music, or at least you got out of the music business.
Yeah.
Right, but I mean, so you were saying earlier that was partly because of, well, it was because of the difficulty of getting paid in the sort of rock music world. So, we should talk about that. So, describe your early experiences working with Zappa and how it was that you were, you know, willing to move from a sort of what could have been a very comfortable ongoing situation in an orchestra to something completely precarious.
Right. Well, that's exactly how it was. Of course, I didn't know that going in.
Right. They don't tell you that.
I figured I equated fame or popularity with money, and that's not usually the way it works necessarily. But, you know, I started working with Frank right away. As far as I was in that recording studio over 15 hours a day, you know, and it never occurred to me to ask him, how am I going to get paid for this? You know, we'd get paid after the gigs. In those days, it was they get lined up right after the gig, and Kirby would stand there with a sack of money, and he'd just peel off a few hundreds. And that was how you got paid. And but I should have known. I tell the story where, you know, the first weekend, Frank said we were going to go up and we're playing two college gigs up in upstate New York, and he said he'd make about $500. Well, $500 was a huge sum of money then. I don't think I ever held $500 in my hand at that time. You know, I was making $132.50 a week with a symphony. And when we went on the world tour, because it was the taxpayer money, we were getting $170 a week. And I thought I'd died and gone to heaven then. So $500, that got my attention. Well, when we got back, we got $300, and Herbie said he was going to give the rest to us later. And I'm still waiting. So I should have known right away that something was fishy there.
You'll have to get in touch with Gail Zappa. Maybe she can.
God rest her soul. Yeah, that's another story. But
yeah.
So, you know, we went along, and then by the time we went back to L.A. and did a few tours, they said, here's what we'll do. Rather than pay you only when we're working, or when you're doing gigs, how about we pay you $250 every week, week in and week out, whether you're playing or not, and then every quarter, every 3 months, in other words, we'll have a meeting, do the accounting, divvy up the excess. I said, well, I don't care. You know, it doesn't make any difference to me. I mean, I was, $250 a week was great for me. I thought that was just wonderful money. And but somehow, when we'd have the meetings, there was never any excess. And it was always something like, well, actually, we went over, you actually owe us money, but we won't, that's all right, we'll still pay you. But, you know, we had to buy this amp, and we had to buy that thing, and we had to play plane tickets and this and that. So But I didn't care. You know, now the older guys were very suspicious. You know, like Don and Bunk, and I said, they had the right edit there. So, well, what do you mean? You know, where's the money? I was so happy to be playing and doing all this great stuff. I didn't care what was going on. My rent was only $250 a month. I had a nice house in Laurel Canyon. What the hell do I care? So, but then later on, things started changing, and I started realizing that the music business was very treacherous business. And everybody's out to screw you. And so, and it's always going to happen, and I'm sure you're aware of this, when the business people run up against the artist, the business people always win. They know what they're doing. You don't. All you want to do is play your art, play your music, write your song, compose your quartet, whatever it is you want to do. That's what you want to do. You don't want to hear about the other stuff. And so you're very passive. So it's very easy to take advantage of it. And I'd say 90% of musicians are like that. It's just inbred into us. It's just the way we are.
Yeah.
Their heads are in the, their minds in the stars somewhere, and the arts and the music and whatever it happens to be. And so we're very easy. It's very easy to take advantage of musicians as a group.
Well, they're creatures of passion, and so they'll follow their passion with absolute devotion, and
right.
and it's true, and on a certain level that can make them easy to take advantage of. Well, okay, so I'm really curious about what it was like recording with Frank Zappa, because the thing I find really fascinating about the early Mothers albums is they're clearly very carefully made. They're beautifully played. They're really nicely recorded. They work incredibly well as sort of musical statements. They have a flow to them. They take you somewhere. But at the same time, I can't for the life of me understand how they were actually put together. Because you take something like Uncle Meat, which I think is about 2 hours long, right? And it's got all these little fragments of music. Some of them are very short. It's sort of like a giant collage. And I'm just curious, was there a design to that? When you were working on it, did you have a sense of this is where this part will fit? Or were you just working on little short fragments of music the whole time?
No, I think we, well, there were some of that, like little fragmented things. But I think Frank, and a lot of what Frank did was on the run. I mean, he just on the fly. I don't think he sat down and figured it all out. He may have in some cases, but he did just whatever sounded good. And plus, remember, he was working with a highly accomplished engineer, Dick Kunk, who was really something. I mean, he was, and at that time, there were very few 16-track, or was it 12, 16-track studios available. Everything was 4, 8-track. And now you had all this stuff that you could overdub and cut in and out and phase, and I don't even know all the technical terms, but so he was just having a ball. Plus, Frank had a great sense of humor and kind of a twisted sense of humor, really, and kind of a cuckoo, I mean, a poo-poo caca sense of humor, you know, heavy in the toilet humor, you know, nasty, dirty, na-na-nini, that kind of stuff. Which was new at the time. You know, today it seems kind of silly, but at the time it was very, risque and very counterculture. So he was able to put in snorks and bleeps and bloops. And we messed around with a lot of stuff in the studio, you know, different sounds and playing with brushes on a phone book and all that kind of stuff, you know. But it was mostly, most of the stuff I did when I first came in was, I mean, it was all recorded separately, for example, I redid all the drum tracks to Reuben and the Jets. He didn't like the way Billy played them, so he wanted me to overdub them the way he wanted it to sound. So I did, and I added a lot of xylophone and marimba and so forth onto some of the tunes. Especially, in fact, I think the very opening of Uncle Meat was marimba and vibraphone. The melody was played, and that was Ruth Underwood, and I played that. Ruth hardly remembers that. She said she was in such a state of mind that she hardly remembers. But we worked real hard on that stuff, and it was fun, and it was new, it was different stuff. Nobody, he had a style all his own, and so it was a lot of fun. But he pieced a lot of stuff together, and he made a career out of it. I mean, I think up to the very end, he was pulling stuff out of recordings he had from some gig in Podunk, and then he put it with a symphony piece, and he just mesh it all together. I don't know if anybody could ever even figure it out. And I don't even know if he left instructions. He'd have to ask Joe Travers, who was the Waldmeister with all of Frank's recorded material now. And he does a hell of a job, by the way. But, I don't know. But he just kind of winged it, I think, on a lot of stuff.
Well, he had to have been one of the most creative people who ever worked in rock music, for sure.
Yeah, I think he was certainly, you'd have to say, the first.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you were actually recording these albums, so he would show up with a piece of sheet music, or he would play it for you, yeah. Or yeah.
No, he would usually have it written out, which made it a lot easier because I just read the chart and he'd put the phones on and the tape would roll and there you go, play right over the top of something was already done. It was pretty easy.
So
although some of the parts were kind of hard.
Did you have to approach your instrument in a different way at all when you were working with Zappa? Did he ask you to do things that were ever outside of your training or things that you were accustomed to?
No, not as far as the playing. I did some different stuff. I mean, you know, I mentioned that one, that circle of instruments, and I was always bringing in new stuff to, break drums and gongs and stuff, bicycle horns and all kind of stuff that I used to use. And he had incorporated those right away. I mean, whatever I brought in, he would use it right now.
So
that was kind of fun. And that lasted even after we got out to L.A. I remember we did one of the first gigs, we did the Whiskey A Go-Go, which may have been recorded. I can't remember. But I used a lot of funky percussion instruments on that session, on those dates. So he would... But I didn't even own anything. And I didn't own a vibraphone. That was his. And a marimba, that was his stuff. I owned my drums and some percussion stuff, but he owned all the timpani and all that kind of stuff. In fact, I heard he sold that vibraphone for $57,000 in that auction.
That's an expensive vibraphone. Wow.
That was probably more than I made the whole time I played. I don't know.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. The trajectory that you're describing is amazing, and it's like you just sort of landed from one amazing situation working with extraordinary artists to another. And in addition to that, so you were playing at places like the Whiskey A Go-Go, which was obviously a hotbed of counterculture and up and coming artists, and so you must have been meeting some of those people in Los Angeles at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I met a lot of the guys and the Doors and, I don't know, just everybody was there. And everybody was there. Where we really met a lot of guys was there was a club on the East Sunset Strip, east of where the Roxy and the Whiskey and all that was. And Marshall Brevitz had a rock club called The Experience, and which he had a similar rock club, big rock club in Miami. We played down there many times, and Frank and Marshall got along real well, and Frank helped Marshall out a lot of times, so Marshall returned a favor. So all the guys would go over there, and you never knew who was going to – Marshall would hire acts to play, but oftentimes whoever was in town would get up and just jam or play for free. So you'd hear Hendrix or Joe Cocker or – the Mothers or the Bonds of the Dog Band or Jefferson Airplane. But whoever happened to be in town, they would go over there and jam. So you got to meet all these guys, And it was a lot of fun. And, of course, Marshall, to his detriment, but he'd give us free drinks, which was probably the wrong thing to do. But that's what he did. And so everybody was happy to be there. So it was a great club, So you got to meet a lot of guys. And we'd go to the Troubadour a lot. I played a week there with Tim Buckley, and I met that crowd, and some of the guys used to hang around there. And there was a few places in town. There was one place way out in Topanga Canyon called the Corral, and that was kind of the home turf of Canned Heat. Bob Height and a lot of the guys lived out there, so they jammed over there a lot. So even before I joined Beefheart, we'd get down to Malibu a lot and then take the Topanga Canyon route back over the hill and stop at the Corral and sit in and have a few beers. And that was a lot of fun. You'd meet a lot of the people. Everybody was just kind of drifting around those days because it was very kind of hippified then, you know, kind of the middle part of the flower movement, I guess you'd say. So people were kind of loose and free with their time. It was a lot of fun.
In order to help keep this podcast going, I've decided to accept some highly select sponsors that I think could really make your life better. On this episode, I'd like to welcome my new sponsor, Encoda. That's N-K-O-D-A. If I had to sum up Encoda in a few words, it's basically the Spotify of sheet music. It's available on all major platforms, including iOS, Android, Mac, and Windows. If you've ever wanted to look at a score for study purposes or just check out some potential repertoire without wanting to pay full price, Encoda is your solution. They have an extensive library of tens of thousands of scores from all periods, all styles, and many different publishers. You can view high-resolution scores and parts. The app is easy to navigate and is a pleasure to use. Download it from your app store or start a free trial and see for yourself. And if you like it, it's available on a subscription basis. That's nkoda.com.
What you're describing is just an amazing and I think quite a unique historic moment also in music with just an incredible amount of creativity pouring out from all directions. And I mean, did you feel that you were sort of creatively involved in Zappa's material? Like, in other words, did you have any input into how you would play or what you would play, or was it just a question of Frank giving you, lines to work on and he'd tell you how he wanted them exactly in every detail?
It depends on what it was. If it was something he'd written, you know, and I was playing the vibraphone or something like that, I would just play whatever the chart was. But when it came to drumming or percussion, it was just you'd play whatever you wanted to play. And so you play your own style. And of course, if you happen to get a solo or something, that would be your stuff. But it was pretty straightforward. It really wasn't anything that it wasn't that unusual. I mean, the playing might have been unusual, but the situation wasn't that unusual. But anything that he had written, he always had charts, which was good because, you know, you didn't have to fool around. It was right there and you just play the chart.
Right. So that stands in contrast to what it was like working with Don Van Vliet.
Yeah.
So actually, so I'll just briefly say for anyone who's listening that you wrote a very interesting and very insightful article comparing Zappa and Beefheart, which is available, I think, on beefheart.com.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'll provide a link for that for anyone who wants to read it because it's a very interesting article. But maybe you could.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, I did. It was very interesting because in a certain sense, it's hard to think of two more different creative personalities than those two people. So I wonder if you remember how you first came into contact with Don when you first met him and what your impressions were.
Yeah. I first met him over at Frank's house. He was renting the Tom Mix Log Cabin in Laurel Canyon. And this was probably in, maybe late 68 or early 69. And I was downstairs rehearsing. And I came up for somebody to leave or something. And there was this guy just sitting there in his armchair with that green coat and with the fur on it and the top hat. And he said, "Well, hello, how are you?" And I said, "Hi, how you doing?" And I said, aren't you Captain B or something? And he said, "Yeah, aren't you Archer?" So we got to talking and had a nice conversation and I left. Well, then later on, a couple months later, we played a big charity gig for the, LA Free Press or something. I forget who it was for, down at the old Hullabaloo Club, which was going to turn into the new Aquarius Theater, where they did Hair and all that. But at that time, it was still a rock joint. And there was a big concert there, a big festival. And they had Jethro Tull and Canned Heat and Don Ellis and Captain Beefheart and the Mothers of Invention. So, and I'd never heard Don play or any of the guys. I hadn't heard any of their stuff. Although maybe I can't remember if I'd heard Trout Mess Replica. I may have heard Trout Mess Replica a little bit and it knocked me out. So anyway, so when we weren't playing and they were, I went out and sat in the audience and listened to their stuff. And I thought, this is just great. I can't believe this stuff. You know, I mean, it's just wonderful stuff. So after the gig, I went back and we talked for a while and met all the guys. And Don said, hey, he said, why don't you come out to the house sometime and say hello or whatever. I said, well, I sure will. So I did. And in fact, sometimes we were coming over to Topanga and I'd stop, but they lived in Woodland Hills, which was kind of on the way, the notorious Trout House in the, on Ensenada Drive in Woodland Hills. So we'd stop over there and talk with Don or the guys, and he'd play me what we were working on at the time and play some of the Trout Mess stuff. And at that time, everything was muffled because there was a house next door and they didn't want to disturb them. So, but it was a great time. And so that's how I kind of got to meet them. And then later on in 69, Frank decided he was going to break up the Mothers. And I think for two reasons. One is it was very expensive to travel with nine guys on the road, or eight guys, however many we were carrying, plus little shadow crew we had. Plus, Frank, I think, got to the point where he wanted to do, all the guys who were making money were the guys who had three or four members.
Right.
You know, the Cream, Blue Cheer, Vanilla Fudge, I don't know what, the Jefferson Starship, I guess they were called by that time. And, of course, they had great material. That's what they're making. But there were also fewer guys to pay. So I think he got his idea that it would be better to do a group with four members rather than eight or nine. So that was what he had in mind. And he told everybody, he said, we'll all go out and play with other groups and then we'll come back and get together, which is all baloney. Anyway, so he decided to have, he got Ian Underwood to play and me and, of course, Frank. And he hired a bass player called Jeff Simmons. And that was the quartet. And so we started rehearsals. And it was some pretty good stuff, but I hate to say it, nothing against Jeff, but I just didn't like the guy. We couldn't get along. I didn't like the way he played. I thought he was, I'd been playing with Roy Estrada for a couple of years. It was phenomenal. And we were very good friends and playing with a new guy and his attitude. I just didn't like it. And Frank wouldn't come to rehearsal that much. So I stopped going. And right about that time, I had been going out to, the timeline, I'm not too sure, but all around this time, I'd been going out to Ensenada Drive, and Don wanted me to join the band. So, and John French left. So I started playing drums with him, but we didn't get a lot done, but we had some material. And about that time, both Zappa and Beefheart had a gig at the Experience Club, the two-day set. And I ended up playing drums with both bands. And I think that was probably the only time that both bands ever played together. It was certainly the only time I ever played with both at the same time. So the next thing, and that was, that must have been very late November of 69. So, but what was pressing, what was coming up was Frank had a big concert gig with a group he was going to call the Mothers, and the L.A. Philharmonic was Zubin Mehta, who was the conductor at the time, a music director maybe. And that was going to be out at Pauley Pavilion at UCLA in West Los Angeles. So he started into rehearsals. Well, I just didn't go to the rehearsals. I wasn't interested. And I started getting involved with Beefheart more. And anyway, long story short, Frank called me up and he said, hey, he said, are you going to make rehearsals? Or he said, I really need you to play. And I said, Frank, I said, look, I said, I don't think it's going to happen anymore. I said, I'm going to go along with Don now and play with Beefheart. And he said, oh, he said, well, okay. And I said, well, no hard feelings, but that's pretty much it. So he got, I think for the gig, he got Billy Mundy to come and play. And actually, we went out to hear the gig. I can't remember if it was, it may have been Don and Jan and I went out to hear it, or maybe it was Ian and Ruth. I can't remember. There were three of us. We went out to hear the show. It was pretty good. I mean, the mothers did a good job. I thought Frank was a little disrespectful to Zubin Mehta. You know, he kind of made fun of him and stuff. But that's what Frank did, you know. But the show was pretty good. And that was it, you know. So I never played with him after that.
Was that a difficult decision to make?
Not really, because, you know, well, there was a lot of things, Sam. One thing, I was fed up with the, I didn't understand, I didn't have a good grasp of why Frank felt the need to break up the mothers. And to me, we were doing a lot of work. It seemed like we were touring a lot. Everybody was making money. He was making money. I thought, why is he breaking it up? It just didn't make any sense. The records deals were there. And so it kind of hurt my feelings. And I remember we played a gig in Charlotte, the Charlotte, North Carolina Jazz Festival. And I went out and was having breakfast with Frank. And that's when he says, I think I'm going to break up the mothers. And I about got sick to my stomach. I said, you are? I said, what the hell for? And he said, well, he said, I think we do better with a smaller group and blah, blah, blah. And he said, but I want you to play drums. And so I said, well, you know, I was both sad and glad. I was sad that the group was breaking up, but glad that I was still able to play with him and with the other couple other guys. But as it went on, and we had a bad last meeting, you know, with all the guys and Herbie and all that crap. And I just got real sour about the whole thing. And we got cheated out of some money. In fact, we got cheated out of quite a bit of money. In fact, we had to sue 20 years later to get record royalties that we never got. Frank uses to buy equipment and so forth that should have gone to us. But that's another story. So I was very disillusioned with the whole thing. And I was really enjoying going out there and meeting with Don and the guys with Beefheart. And the music was great, and Don had all these ideas. I mean, he had a line of crap that, you know, I mean, he could talk you into anything. So he had me convinced this was going to be the biggest thing since the Rolling Stones, you know. So I thought, well, shit, you know. I said, I don't care as long as it's solid, man. I just want something that's solid and something I can count on. I didn't realize I was going from the frying pan into the fire, but. That's how it happened. So, as a matter of fact, I didn't really know what I was supposed to be doing in the band. I was playing drums, and we'd get together, and I was kind of into freeform playing at the time. And, of course, that wasn't meshing in too much with what they were doing. So they gave me the records, but nobody ever said, look, I think you should learn to play John French's drum parts from Trout Mask. Nobody ever said that. So I listened to it, and I said, that's great stuff. We sit down and play, and I'd play something else. So I was already kind of losing interest, and it was very loose, and I was having fun, BSing with Don, and we'd stay up all night and talk and that kind of thing. But as far as musically, I didn't exactly know where I was fitting in. So I kind of stopped going out there. And I think for a while I had the Bill and Mark came over to live at my house in Laurel Canyon for a while. One day I came home, they were gone, all their stuff was gone. I thought, that's interesting. So anyway, I talked to a few people. So I called out there and to Ensenada Drive, and John French picked up the phone. I thought, well, okay. So I said, what's going on? He said, why don't you just come on out here? So I did. So it turned out they decided to get John back to play the drums. So I was kind of out of a gig. And I forget who suggested it. They said, well, you play marimba, and there's nobody playing the second guitar parts. Why don't you play the marimba on the second guitar, the second guitar parts on the marimba?
Because Jeff Cotton had left by that point.
Yes, he'd been gone before I ever really came out there. I mean, as far as when I started playing with him, he was around when I started going out to just meet them socially and so forth. But yeah, he'd gone. So they needed somebody to play the other guitar parts. So I started doing that. In fact, at first I didn't have a marimba. I used to play it on xylophone. But we finally got a good 4.5-octave marimba and I was able to use that. And so, so we'd just sit down and Bill would, he'd come over to my house and we'd sit down and he'd play the parts for me and I'd write them down and score for him. And then I just put them up and play them until I memorized them. And so that's how I learned the charts, you know, what was being played then. So to answer your question, I there really wasn't that big of a, I mean, there was a transition, but it was an incremental and it wasn't like, oh, I'm doing this and oh, now I'm doing this. It was just kind of floated from one thing into the next.
So we were starting to talk about your early work with Beefheart and how you came to join that group and how at first there wasn't really, it wasn't clear what your role would be musically.
I think they wanted me to play a little like John, and but I didn't know how to play like John. I don't suppose John knew how to play like me. So, but I wasn't that much interested in it, and I didn't know that was a suggested role for me to play. So I just kind of ignored the whole thing, and I think I told you about that already. But the irony was, later on, several years later, after one of the albums, I think it was Spotlight Kid, John left again. And so this time, when it became on me to play drums exclusively, I had the tapes of John's drumming for Troutmask. And so I was able to listen to those tapes, write down there again, I'd write it down in score form and then rehearse it until I knew how to play it. And play it precisely the same as John, but pretty close. So that's how I eventually ended up playing that stuff anyway. Just the way he played it pretty much. And I like his style of playing better than mine, but it was certainly good, and so that's what we did. And the same thing with decals and everything else, of course. It was just, I was there from the beginning, so it didn't matter.
Well, decals, there's some tracks where you're both playing drums at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and there's also tracks where you're playing marimba. So I want to talk about how that came about, because,
sure. Yeah,
so where did the idea arise that you could both play drum kits? Because that's a very unusual setup for a record where you have two drummers. And so
I was kind of used to it because it was Zappa. We had both two drummers, and Jimmy Carl Black played, you know, kind of the steady workhorse stuff, and I got to band a little bit, but we both played the drums, and then I played some other stuff. But so I don't remember why it came up that way. I guess because I was playing marimba, but on some song there was no marimba, so I figured I could put a second drum part, I guess. There were just two or three, I think. I can't remember how many there were. I remember Japan and the Dishpan, and there were several. So John already had an established part that he played, so my parts were just ad-libbed, you know, on the record, and pretty much I played it similar on the road, but there was a lot of ad-libbing there. In fact, I remember we recorded that at the record plant, as I remember, out in West L.A., and when it came time to put my drum parts on over top of the track, I said, well, let me try one. So I went out in the studio and they played the tape and I played one and it was great. I just loved it, you know, and everybody was jumping up and down. Well, but they didn't record it. So I said, okay, let's do a real one now. So I went back out and sat down and I played. It was okay, but I thought the first one was much better. But the one that got on the album was the second choice.
Huh. How would you describe the difference between your style of playing the drums and John's? Because on that record, you get a chance to compare them, and they're actually in the final mix, they're panned left and right. So, and it's very easy to tell the difference. It's very easy to tell who's playing what because you have very different approaches. Yeah. But how would you describe that difference?
John was, you know, more stylistic, and he played more. Harder to describe. what that stuff was like. You might call it Delta, March, bluesy, jazzy. I don't know what you'd call it, but he had a definite style. You know, boom, boom, ta, boom, ta, boom, ta, boom, boom, ba. You know, that kind of stuff. And so he was very good at that. Now, probably had I worked at it long enough, spent a couple of months, I probably could have imitated that style pretty good. As it was, like I said, later I played almost exactly the same parts that he had played, but I learned it from him, the part. It wasn't just, I'd come up with my own. Now, as far as decals, I played more freeform, more, if you will, pictures and colors and shades and that type of thing. More moody. I don't know about moody, but, you know, it played around more, you know. And a lot of times I would base it on what I was hearing in the phones, you know, like, for example, the second guitar part or Bill's, or maybe Bill's guitar, and I would listen to it and I'd play along with it. I play off of his part. And so that's why it had some, that's why it has some meaning. That's why it touched down with the piece as it went along.
So, but how involved was Don in all of this? Because you're describing, you know, learning parts from the other members of the band and so on.
Yeah.
What was Don's role in all this? Did he ever give you things to work on? Was he paying attention? Did he?
Later, but, you have to understand that Don had no idea how any of this stuff went together. He didn't have a clue, Sam. Maybe sometimes he did, but, you know, there's a misunderstanding. I don't know if I should say this, but there's a misunderstanding going around that Don would work out these parts with the guys and he'd stand there until they learned it and then they'd put it all together and say, I want this here and I want that. That almost never happened. It was left to whoever picking out the whatever parts of pieces he played from the piano and played on the guitar, or in some cases the drums or bass, it was up to them how it went together for the most part. So Don had no clue. He didn't know that this guitar part went with that bass part and this, it was going to touch down here at bar four. And he didn't have any idea of that stuff. It was no different than his. I mean, he didn't have any idea what he was going to sing on that stuff. It wasn't like he had lyrics that he wrote for Dr. Dark, or I shouldn't say Dr. Dark, because I don't know about that one, but some of the music, he had no idea what he was going to do. So he'd just take a poem that he had written and he'd transpose it on top of a piece that went together, put together by the guys in the band. Usually it was either John or more in my time was Bill. Bill would pull pieces, you know, pull parts off this mishmash of piano ramblings that Don did in these two-hour sessions. He'd sit and just bang away at the piano. And he'd pick parts out of there. And I'm sure he picked out just whatever he thought would sound good and play it the way he thought it would go together well. And then maybe Don had some input and say, well, why don't you put that on top of this because it sounds similar. I don't know. I didn't sit in those sessions. But that's how that stuff was put together. And that is why, and this is an important part, the band always sounded different depending on what band it was.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Every new band he had was a different sound. It wasn't because Don decided to change his style. It was because whoever was picking these pieces out and coming up with these parts and putting parts here and there and everything, it was how they did it, how they played. So I don't know the later bands as well as I knew the previous band, but I'm sure that's how it was.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're saying that, but Don really had no idea how these different parts would go together, but, I mean, presumably he was basically...
Only in a general sense.
In a general sense, but I think one of the reasons why these albums continued to fascinate people so much, I mean, the result is extremely unique. There's nothing else that sounds like those records. And part of that, obviously, is because of the extremely high caliber of the musicians playing it, the obvious dedication, the tremendous skill of all the players, and the creativity of everyone involved. But there's also the fact that the process by which these albums were made, I think, is unique. And I can't think of anything that was made in a similar way. And I'm thinking also in terms of 20th century classical music and all of this. And there's really nothing where I can point to and say it's similar. So this is the result of an extremely unique way of working. And I guess my question is it fair to call Don the composer of these pieces, given that he couldn't have done it on his own? Obviously, he needed you guys, and you guys needed also to sort out what all the parts were, figure out how they could fit together, more or less arrange them. What is your point of view on that?
I think Don was the driving force, and I think he was a composer, but he was a co-composer. And I don't know about John, because I wasn't around John that much when he was doing that musical director task, but I was around Bill a lot, and I guarantee you that he should have gotten co-writing credit on a lot of that stuff. Because it was as much him as it was Don, I'll tell you right now. And it happened with other guys too. But so he was Don the composer? Yes. Would that stuff have got done without Don doing that? No. But there was a lot of guys that had a hand in that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Much more so than say with Frank, who Frank wrote everything. I mean, at least as far as the written music went, as far as the composition went, wrote everything. There was some ad lib parts in it. There were solos and that kind of thing. But as far as the core music, Frank was the composer.
So
different story with Don.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, the other side of it too, is that the members of the Trout Mask Band have all described at various times what it was like working with Don at that time and how difficult it was psychologically and emotionally. And I haven't heard too much in terms of what that was like during Lichmai Dekalzov. So from your perspective, did he treat you badly? Was it a tense sort of environment, or had things improved by that point?
No, but if I can interject, I've heard both John and Bill, especially John, and maybe even Jeff Cotton. I heard your great interview with him from Hawaii. Because of the relationship they had with Don, I didn't have quite the same relationship, but I think they were reluctant to say that Don didn't compose all that music. I think it was out of respect for Don and starstruck. You know, starstruckness, that's a good word, because of that. And I think they were so used to deferring to Don that they didn't feel comfortable saying that. But I guarantee you that a lot of that stuff was, you know, now on to the treatment, whichever wants to hear about that. I saw some of that. It was mostly with the guys that had been in the Trout group. And I was shocked the first time at I saw it, you know, like we'd be rehearsing and we'd be doing this, and all of a sudden we'd stop and Don would be on somebody's case. And a lot of times it was Bill. And it was never, you know, I don't think I ever heard him criticize anybody for not playing the part or because he played the part wrong, because he didn't know what the part was supposed to be anyway. It was always about, the way he was playing it, the feel that he was putting into it wasn't right. And I have to say, I think a lot of times that came up because Don himself was feeling wrong, you know. If you put on top of that he rarely rehearsed with the band. I mean, we didn't just sit down and Don pull out a mic and start singing his poetry on top of the song. It didn't happen that often. Maybe before a tour it would, but you know, almost never really. So he would get these notions in his mind, and he would, I don't know, he's bored, or he didn't know what to say, or he was felt like he was put on the spot. So he'd always direct the attention away from himself onto somebody else. You know, it was invariably Mark or Bill. And the first time it happened, I thought, what the hell? And so he'd say, well, Bill is this and that and everything. So he'd say, Artie, you talk. I'd turn to Bill and I'd say, well, Bill, what's going on? So Bill would tell me something that sounded logical to me. And Don said, it's full of shit. That's not true. That's not, you know. So, and all of a sudden you're into this scene. And I think other bands go through that to an extent, you know, but this happened, you know, fairly regular. So it was better when he wasn't around. We got a lot more done. And then finally, when we left L.A. and we moved up to near Santa Cruz, and then after that, we moved up to Humboldt County, California, the Redwoods. We'd still have those, what we got to refer to as talks. Like the band would just say, you might as well put your instrument down. We're going to have an hour talk. And so usually I just sit there and I, it really got to be a pain in the ass because there was never any substance to it. It was all woo woo horse pucky. It didn't, you know, none of it was, it was all crap. And so I'm sure, and I think most of it was gone. You know, he just, I don't know if he felt like he's put on the spot or he felt like screwing with somebody. I don't know what. I don't recall it ever being turned on me. If it had, I probably would have left. But that was, you know, bigger maybe, and maybe Don felt intimidated by me. I don't know. But it was, yeah, pretty regular. Well, fast forward a couple of years, and by the time we got Roy in the band, that stuff slowed down quite a bit. And then by the time, Elliot Ingber, Wingdale Fingerling, he came in the band, slowed way down. In fact, Elliot yelled at him one time. He said, why don't you get the hell out of here, man? He says, better next time you come here, you better get your ass in here and sing. He said, you never sing. You know, he really wrote him a riot act. Don left. So that kind of helped out a little bit. And then by the time those guys left and Alex St. Clair came into the band, well, it was really getting good. And we didn't have many of those talks at all.
So let's just talk a little bit about decals for a second, because okay. So I know that with the guitar and the bass sound and things like that, and the drums, Don had often very specific requests. Like he would ask Bill to play with a particular gauge of string, a really thick sort of guitar string.
Don.
Yeah. And you know, he would ask that they play with metal picks and so on and so forth. What about the
that was going on before decal.
Yeah. Well, right. So what about with your marimba parts? Did he have any particular idea about what he wanted the marimba to sound like?
Not a peep. I never heard one word about the marimba except, you know, I get a compliment or something. One time, I think that there was a marimba break in the piece. It was a lot of cacophony going on. And I was like, blah, 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 play this marimba thing. And it lasted, I don't know, 30 seconds of that. And that was something I pulled off of Don's tape. But I just ended up playing something that I thought sounded good. And I wrote it down, and that became the part. And I played that part on the recording. With the part, he couldn't have, if you held a gun to his head, he couldn't have told you one note that was in that thing. He had no idea. But the funny part about it was well rehearsed. And I remember when we did with Bill, the marimba and the guitar, we were in separate rooms and we just played through the phones. And so we had played it so well and we thought so much the same that I think we just did one, maybe two takes and got the whole thing. And that was all free. There was no one, two, three, four. It was all floating. over the, which is tricky to do,
Yeah.
If you don't know the guy you're playing with.
Well,
So to answer your question, no, I don't think Don ever had a comment about anything I ever played in marimba at all.
Yeah, I have to relate an anecdote about that. So you just mentioned the introduction part of The Clouds Are Full of Wine.
Clouds Are Full of Wine.
Yeah. So when I was 18 years old and I started studying composition, I went to take lessons with a guy in Toronto who is a huge Beefheart fan. And the first assignment he ever gave me was to, he gave me a tape of Decals. And he gave me that track, The Clouds Are Full of Wine. And he said, you're going to transcribe this by ear for next week.
Oh.
So that was my first composition lesson.
Did you send me a copy of that?
No, I don't think I did. No.
Okay.
So that was my first composition assignment. And I took it home and I had to listen to it about 300 times to do it because... First of all, figuring the rhythms out is not easy because they don't relate to a common pulse and the tempo keeps changing.
Right. There's no steady rhythm. It's a flip. The notes are easy. They're not that much to the notes.
Yeah.
The pitch. But the reason, heck, if you sent it to me was I remember years ago, somebody sent me a chart and he had meticulously written this thing out. And so it could be produced the same way every time. And I wrote him back. I said, no, man, that's not it. I mean, I'm really impressed with what you did, but this was not played that way. We didn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, it was a float and a feel, and we just kind of played it over. As a matter of fact, you could probably characterize a lot of the Beefheart parts as floating over the other part.
Mm-hmm.
They would touch down. I think it was interesting, that guy, Tony Malone, I don't know if you know him, he figured out a way to write down all those parts and have them sync according to what they sounded like on the record so other guys could learn to play the tunes. And he did a pretty nice job of it. But there again, it wasn't conceived that way at all.
Right. Yeah, and the challenge is in those passages where you're all playing together at the same rhythm, you had to somehow figure out how to play together and do all those tempo changes.
You just develop the same spatial feel. That's why John could say, and it would start. He would go 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Because everybody knew what it was. They knew the exact tempo. They knew the exact notes, the feel, everything else. So it was, because it was very well rehearsed, that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, no.
The funny part about it is, while we're on that subject, much later on, when after John left the second time and I started playing the drum part, we redid a lot of those, where a lot of those parts went, and which to me made more sense than some of them the way they'd been recorded earlier. And we're playing for Don, and he loved it because he had no idea what, he just, oh yeah, that's right. But we made a lot of changes. So it wasn't like somebody that came in that with this composition said, here, play this. And he said, oh, no, that's the wrong note. And this beat goes here. Didn't happen. But the way you played it, he always seemed to be able to tell if somebody was not into it 100%. They're just kind of playing around with it. That was one thing that he demanded as a kind of a quasi band leader is that you had to be 100% when you played that stuff. And we were. That's why it usually came out pretty well. I think the audiences that heard it liked the energy as much as they liked the music.
Do you remember when the album was released? Did you hear it when it came out?
No. Well, after it was released, sure. They'd always send you a box of albums or whatever they sent you, and you'd listen to the actual record, but of course we just heard it all in the studio, although we didn't hear it with a vocal.
Yeah, and well, what did you...
It was the first time we heard it with a vocal.
What did you think when you first heard the recordings? Did it sound the way you expected? Was it surprising?
Pretty much, yeah. And of course, with a voice on it, it was different. As far as I was concerned, it was an instrumental group, and then he put a voice on later. So, that's just the way it was. So, and I was an instrumentalist, and I always I always listen to the instruments, and I always listen to instrumental playing together. And to this day, I don't hear lyrics very well. I was an instrumentalist. You can name for me a dozen popular songs. I couldn't tell you 10 words, many of them. But if I like the music, I like the song, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, with the possible exception, to answer your question, is the last album we did was called Unconditionally Guaranteed. And we really worked hard on that album. And we all thought we had a really, really good album. Because there was a little bit of the old stuff, but there was some actual good songs in there and stuff you could tap your foot to and sing along with. And it was my contention all along that we should play some more commercial stuff. That way we would get more gigs, maybe more people buy the records, and we'd make some more money, you know. As it turned out, I was dead wrong. You know, that group would never have been believed as a commercial group. But at any rate, so when we played that album and we rehearsed it and we really had it good, we went down to a studio in Hollywood, and Andy DiMartino had an office nearby. We laid down all the tracks and they were beautiful. They were just tight and they had a lot of good playing on it. We had a good keyboard man that added Mark Marcellino, and I played drums. I mean, just an alley. Everybody was great. So we all left, went back up to Humboldt County while Don put the vocal tracks on. So I didn't hear any of that. And so when the album was finally printed, they sent us up some copies. And there was a record store in Arcata, California at that time. And they were real big fans and promoters of our music. In fact, they even even rented places to live to Bill and Mark, as I recall. So we got the record, and we went in there and we put it on the turntable and fired it up. And the first couple of songs, I thought, geez, this stinks. And I thought, well, it's going to get better. And the whole album was pretty much like that. And I thought, what have they done? And what they did was, in order to get Don's low growling inflections on, they pumped the track down so low you could hardly hear it. And it's because of that, you couldn't get the feel of the music. And all you could hear was his voice, which is okay. Could it have been better mixed? Maybe. Maybe that's what it was. But it was just a damned embarrassment. And I remember looking up at the guys that owned the record shop and said, I'm sorry, man. You know, it's just no good. So that was the only time that I, which you're alluding to, that I heard the album after it was done. And I thought, Jesus, this stinks. And that was the beginning of the end of the band.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that would have been the last project you worked on with Don.
Well, and it was because of that project and because of the few things that happened after that, that we decided it was time to, you know. So what we did was we got together and said, look, we had a tour coming up. We want X amount of dollars per week. Let's make sure we got a return airfare. We don't want to get stranded over in Paris somewhere. So we called up Andy and said, look, this is what we want. If we don't get it, we're not going on the tour. And so he went out of his mind and called back on the big hubbub. He flies up to Arcata and we all get together. And it was this big meeting and scouting and all this. But nothing ever came of it. And they wouldn't give us the money that we wanted. So we said, screw it. So we said, we ain't going. And I felt sorry for Don years later because he had to put together a few guys. It was terrible. I mean, that was that Blue Jeans and Moonbeams or something. And that tour they did, and everybody was shouting out, Where's Drumbo? Where's Ed Marimba? Where's Zoot Hornrillo? And he had John, poor guy, he had to just joke his way out of it and act like they weren't playing anything like the stuff that was on the records. That was pretty bad, but that was the end of it. And I think they could have come up with a little more money. They just didn't want to be on the receiving end of it, getting the orders.
Okay, so it sounds like you're describing that by the mid-70s, you were starting to get pretty disillusioned with not only the band, but with the music industry generally. So what happened after that? I mean, when this was...
Well, I had already had it with the music industry generally, but I was getting a little bit disillusioned with Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band. And the fact is, we weren't making any money. I mean, we were being provided for, but they weren't getting, $400 or $500 a week in a check account every week. It was just, living hand to mouth, really. It's fun to be artistic if you have somebody to support you.
Yeah, so this was sort of a gradual process, and I guess that at one point you just decided it wasn't worth it. You wanted to do something else. How did that happen?
I was really fed up after Unconditionally Guaranteed, and so was Alex. And so we got together one night and said, "Look, we got to tell the other guys we got to do something." So we called them together, Bill and Mark, and we all sat down and we said, "Look, this can't go on. We can't keep doing this, and we're coming up with sounds like quality stuff, and it's coming out like crap. And besides that, we're not getting paid for it, and we still have to put up all this crap. Don's driving around in a new car, and we're sitting here, So that's when we decided to kind of, and more or less, mutiny is what we did. So then we got together and approached, we had this tour coming up, big tour. We said, now's the time to do it, and we had some negotiating chips. So we did, and it didn't work out. They wouldn't budge. They wouldn't come up with another $50 a week. So how important was it? And Don didn't have any, he didn't know what to do. He had no clue. It was all the, at that time, he was being influenced a lot by the DeMartino brothers, Andy and his brother. They were producing albums. They were, I think, managing him. And they were very assertive guys, New York guys. And Don was following along with what they told him to do. I'm sure that's what it was. Plus, they had friends. They thought they could get into the band and everything would be hunky-dory, except that it wasn't. It was terrible. So I don't know. So Don eventually kind of, I guess he, I don't know how long it was before he did anything after that. Because I think it was by 1978, after I'd got out of the music business, came back in, I went to hear Don at the Whiskey, and I went up to talk to him afterwards, and he asked if I'd play on their new album. He asked me to come around first. I knew what that meant. He was trying to get me in the band. They were doing a new album called Shiny Beast, and they were going to record it up in San Francisco. And I said, "Well, I'm about to start chiropractic college, and I'm not about to stop that because I want to actually get into something that I can count on where I'm calling the shots." And so he said, "Well, come on up and do the album and we'll just pay you for it." So that's what I did. But so by that time, he'd got a band together. And I don't know he had Bruce Fowler, a fabulous musician. And Denny Wally, I think, was playing. And I forget who all was in that band.
Yeah. But at a certain point, you just decided you'd rather do something else, and it didn't occur to you to go back to the classical world or to become an orchestral timpanist or anything like that.
No, not right at that time, because right at that time I got an offer from my father, who I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He had a insurance business and he was doing very well, and so he asked me if I'd like to come back and work with him and learn the insurance business. And I thought, well, I don't know a damn thing about the insurance business, but I don't have anything going on right now. And at that time, the guys were still around, and Bill was still living in Arcade, and I was living there, and see who else. I guess Mark was around. And so Bill was working on some new material, and I'd get down, and I'd have some input on that. Bill did most of it, but I had a little bit of input on it. Some of the music, some of the lyrics, but it was mostly Bill. And I thought, well, this is really good stuff. And the stuff eventually found its way onto the Mallard album. But at that time, I thought, okay, we got this stuff. What are we going to do with it? We don't have a contract. We don't have we don't have any tours. What are we going to do, play taverns? I just couldn't see any future in it. And I got tired of, I get a job here and there and tend a bar and play a little bit of music. And I thought, this is stupid. So I took my dad up on the offer. And that was in 75, I think. Yeah. And I went back to Pittsburgh. And it took me 3 years before I realized it wasn't for me. And to be honest, my dad and I didn't get along. So I said, I'm out of here. I'm going back to Hollywood. So when I did, in fact, I called my friend Barry Barlow with the great drummer with Jethro Tull. And I said, if you have any way to send me some equipment, this I could use it, you know. But I was looking for timpani and marimbas and stuff like that. Well, he sent me a set of drums, which I still have, by the way. And so I started to, I thought, well, I'll just start back into the recording bit. You know, I was doing session work before I left L.A. with Beavart. I did the Smothers Brothers show. I got offered the part for Oh Calcutta, the percussionist for that. I did a record with Al Stewart. It's a pretty good contact. But meanwhile, when I left and you come back 3 years later, it's like, Art who? Oh, did you used to play here? You know, it's all changed. So I was starting all over again. And I had limited amount of equipment. And I got a few gigs, mostly just from hanging around with Ian Underwood. He got me a few gigs. And I thought, this isn't going to work. I mean, and it's not the same. Most of my career was with an organization, with a band. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't like a hired gun cowboy running all over town trying to beat some other guy out of a gig to get to play a marimba part for some, you know. So by that time, I was being treated by a chiropractor in Hollywood, Dr. Joel Hansen. And out of the blue one day, he just mentioned it to me. He brought up, he said, did you ever think about going into chiropractic? I don't know what he saw in me. And I said, well, yeah, but I don't know anything about it. And I said, I'm getting a little too old to start another career. And he said, baloney. He said, here's what you do. You get down to, there was three chiropractic colleges in Los Angeles. He says, you get down to talk to the dean of admissions. And you take a $100 bill and you paste it on your forehead. You walk into the dean and you say, I'd like to start taking classes here. Can I join your college? And he said, they'll let you in. So he was joking, of course, but that's kind of what I did. So I went back to L.A. College because I had plenty of college credits, but mostly in the humanities and the arts, no science courses. So I had to go back to L.A. Valley College and take anatomy, physiology, and physics and biology, all that stuff, just so I could get into the chiropractic school, qualify. So I did that. And I remember the first couple of months I'm in school, I get a call from, I forget the guy's name. I think it was the manager, a road manager with Zappa. And he said, hey, yeah, Frank wanted me to call you. He said, we got this big European tour coming up. I wondered if you can play drums. And I said, what? Meanwhile, a few years ago, I'd come in and I'd practically begged Frank to throw me some studio work, and he didn't give me anything. So now he wants me to play drums on this tour. And I haven't played drums in a few years. But I said, I can't drop everything. And it turned out Vinny Colaluta, forgive me if I'm pronouncing that wrong, real good drummer that he had, he got sick and he couldn't play the tour. So Frank knew I could learn the material quickly and he wanted me to play. I said, I can't. I'm not going to drop this for a couple of months and go over to Europe and play a gig. And I said, why didn't they ask me 2 years before that? You know, I'd have done it, you know. Then my friend Barry Barlow said he was going to quit the Tull, and because he had a couple of girls who were becoming of school age, and he wanted to be around for them. And he said, when they get to the school, I'm going to quit. And he said, I want you to take the gig. I said, really? He said, yeah. And I'm thinking, gee, that's big money. They were making good money. They played all sold out, you know, civic arenas and stuff. And we did a long tour with them, and I knew what kind of audiences they were getting. But at that time, there again, I was already into this new thing. And at that time, I was still in Pittsburgh. And I said, I can't, you know, I just can't do it. I was never offered the job, but I'm sure it would have worked out real well because I knew Ian very well. And the other guys, Jeffrey Hammond and Martin Barr and those guys, you know, we were all good friends because we did a tour together. And I'm sure I would have fitted in very well. But at the time, it was wrong. That kind of goes back to what we were saying about being in the right place at the right time. And being able to come up with the goods, you know. Who knows, maybe I could have been a genuine rock star.
Well, it all worked out in an interesting way.
Yeah.
And you know, you got to participate in some of the most extraordinary musical adventures of the last 50 years, and that's a unique thing to have done.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I was very fortunate, very fortunate, and I sure enjoyed it for the most part.
So did you stay in touch with Don at all after you left the Magic Band?
Oh yes, not for a while, but by the time I got licensed in chiropractic and I practiced a year in Hollywood, I moved back up to where we used to be in North California, and near Trinidad, near up above Eureka, California, on the Redwood Coast. I opened up a practice there in a small town called McKinleyville. Well, sooner or later, I found out that Don was living up there too. So I forget how it worked. Anyway, we got together and spent a lot of time together. In fact, Don would come in for chiropractic treatments to my clinic in McKinleyville. And then we'd get together sometimes, have dinner, or go out for drinks or something. But then one day Don came in and he was, he couldn't stand right. He stood there and he started swaying. And I told Don, I said, "Can you stop that? Can you stop doing that?" He says, "No, I can't." And I said, "Well," so I adjusted him and everything, his low back and moved well. And he was okay for an hour or so. And then so he kept coming in. I finally told him, I had him and Jan in the office. I said, "Look, there's something wrong with you." I said, I don't know what it is. I said, "But you got to see a neurologist and let them diagnose you." I said, "Don't worry about it. You just have to find out what it is. I can't help you with that. It's beyond my capacity to help." So he didn't want to go. And I think he was afraid that he had something deathly wrong with him, which he did. But we didn't know it at the time. So I talked to Jan. I said, "You got to get him to get down there, you know, just make an appointment. They're a pretty good neurologist down in Eureka." Good. So month in, month out goes, and I'd go, like, usually I'd be out partying, and I'd decide to stop over at his house after hours, and I was usually half in the bag when I went over there. So we'd BS, and one night we got to we both got pretty loaded, and having some funny stuff happened. So anyway, about a week later, he calls me up, and we had this big argument on the phone, and I basically said, "Screw you," and hung up the phone, and that was it. And we never spoke again. But later on, I found out that Don had, he had been diagnosed with, which I heard was MS. I never knew for sure that's what it was, but I think that's what it was. And he had the bad kind where you know, a lot of people have MS, they have remissions and exacerbations, they get better and they get worse, and they have a normal lifespan. Well, he had the kind that didn't work out that well. And I think he just went down bad. In the last couple of years, he was pretty much mute, and yeah, it was a bad scene. But I had no knowledge of that. I wasn't, you know. So I finally left I left that area in 2000. And by then, I'd had no contact with Don at all since 93, really. But we live in less than a mile apart from each other, but we had no contact whatsoever. Too bad.
Well, I just have one more question for you. You've been very patient with my ramblings and inquisitions, so thank you for that. It strikes me that 50 years after Trout Mask and Decals and other albums from that period were released, the level of public interest is still extremely high. There are millions of people listening to these albums, and not to mention the Zappa material, of course. And if anything, the audience seems to be expanding, and successive generations discover it and get excited by it. And there's just an enduring fascination with this music. So as somebody who participated in that, who is an active collaborator, why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, they were unique, and they managed to get their stuff out there, Zappa much more than Don. But nothing was being done anything like it at the time, and really since. There's been a few imitators, but it's a hard thing to imitate. Especially the B-part stuff is very difficult to imitate. And I think that because they both died so young, Frank was, I think, only 51. Don was, I don't know if he got to be 70, maybe 60, let's see, late 60s. Of course, he'd quit music, just doing painting exclusively, which is probably what he should have done from the beginning. But at any rate, so they acquired a legendary status. I mean, you can look at bands like The Fall, The Residents. You know, a lot of bands have kind of got similar to that. But most of that was on the backs of guys like Zappa and B-Part. You know, there wasn't anything like it happened before. There was nothing at all. And so I think that plays a lot into it. Plus, there's a lot of myths that have grown up, most of them not true. And so that stuff gets around. And, you know, plus, the stuff is good. I mean, it was so far out at the time that it kind of fits in today. It maybe even a little far out for today. Certainly some of the B-part stuff. A lot of guys, musicians were influenced by it. A lot of composers were influenced by it, portions of it. It's kind of like Stravinsky. You know, I don't think there's a composer alive since 1913 that hasn't been influenced by Igor Stravinsky, and especially The Rite of Spring. It's just, and everybody, they hear that sound like, yeah, I got to do something with that. I got to use it. I got to use that orchestration. I got to use a line like that. Why didn't I think about putting the contrabass together with the piccolo? Or, you know, in a compositional sense, I think that's why they remain. And I suppose some of the stuff is studied. I don't know if it is or not.
Well, it is. I can tell you from personal experience that classical composers and performers are often very familiar with that music, and love it. And they seem to particularly engage with it somehow. Maybe.
Well, you know, it occurred to me that up until maybe the last generation or so, there's never been a fusion of quote classical symphonic chamber music with jazz rock. I mean, to where the boundaries were blurred to where you could do something like it would make it into more of the mainstream of whatever's going on now in a different way than it could have, say, in 1950 or 1960 or even 1970. It's just, you guys today, composers and musicians, I mean, they're all so good. You know, they all play so good, they write good, and they, you know, they've heard everything that was ever recorded. And so it's there's kind of an interesting blend or fusion of that stuff, which it never could have happened before. When I was in the conservatory scene, there was never any jazz taught in any school. I mean, they may have had Berkeley and where is it, Philly or Boston or whatever, but there was no jazz ever taught at the conservatories, let alone any funk or anything like that, you know. That was all done on a pop idiom, you know. It was done in clubs and back rooms. But now, all that stuff is mainstream, and people combine it. You know, as mentioned earlier, this Collier kid. You know, he's fusing so much stuff together that it's really remarkable, you know, with jazz and harmonic series. Augmentations and microtones, and but the limit to what you could do with tonal harmony, and that's just—it's just time to do that now. It's, you know, people have been doing stuff like that, and what other guys are doing, I had no idea. I wish I did know. And that's why it's nice to hear your music. It's nice to hear what's going on. So I don't know why it. I mean, I don't know if we had any guys like that when we were growing up, just sitting around talking about Bix Beiderbecke or Chick Corea, not Chick Corea, Chick Webb or somebody like that. I don't think it happened that much. But now they got this merging. It's very interesting way it's going, right? So there you have it.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you.
It was a real thrill to talk to you, Sam. I'd like to follow your more of your music.